I believe it's time for us to begin our Bible study together, and so if you would go ahead and open your Bibles to the text of the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24, verse 13, that's where we're at this morning. We want to encourage you to be an active participant in our study. We'll begin in just a moment, but before we begin our study, we're going to bow our heads together in prayer. Would you pray with me, please? Heavenly Father, we thank you for your relationship with us. We thank you for the blessings that you provide to us spiritually and physically. We thank you for the challenge that is set before us as disciples and servants. Help us to live like your Son, to love like your Son, and to look towards heaven like your Son. Please watch over our souls. Help us be aware of our weaknesses and failings in light of your redemption and rescue. This is all offered to you in prayer by the power of your Son. Amen. All right, so is this thing not doing its thing there, old Jesse? I will just stand right here until whatever that's going on there. I'm not quite sure what the buttons and situations are. But either way, I can just kind of stand. That's a good success for me in some ways, too. It's a little bit of a challenge because I'm a little bit more mobile than this, but we'll see what we can do. So if you remember from last Sunday, we are in the middle part of the final chapter of the Gospel of Luke. A couple points of clarification and remembrance. Point number one is to recognize that the Gospel of Luke is a two-part thing, and so it attaches directly to the book of Acts. And so while we're at the close of the Gospel of Luke, we are also, by other means, at the opening of the book of Acts. And so if the more we kind of think about those as together, are we getting audio through this mic now? Okay, great. I'm free. Well, as free as I can be, I suppose. But the Gospel of Luke is kind of the middle point in a book, not the closing chapter. And so we just kind of use these chapter markers and stuff like that as accommodations. But we are at the high point in some of the most significant aspects of the Bible story. If you think about Genesis chapter 1, Genesis 2, and Genesis 3, those are the opening refrains of God's teaching story, his song he's telling us about what's going to happen. The song opens up with a great explosion of creation. It focuses in on the arrival of mankind to the story. And then very quickly it devolves into a discordant conflict between Adam and Eve and Satan and God that is going to be resolved eventually. The resolution chord takes place in Jesus. The whole picture of head and heel and seed and final seed and Adam and last Adam are being culminated, really in this case, in a space of 50 to 60 days. We have that space between the cross and Acts chapter 1, which is a 50-day-ish range, plus a little more on either side. So at the tomb, which is where we were at roughly last week, you had the recognition of what central fact when the women went there in the Lucan account of the event. What did they recognize very quickly when they got to the tomb? What were some of the key facts? This helps us set the stage. Big fact. He's not there. What's still there, though? What was left behind? Burial clothes. The tomb is open. And mystery is left behind. That's the thing that's like, what's going on? The body should be here. We have a purpose as to why we are here. There are things that we had planned to accomplish in light of seeing through this next step. Their perspective is going to radically shift because we're going to now have Luke shift scene. If you're doing like a movie or a story or you're telling an event back, okay, we were at the tomb before. We're going to go to a road scene. This is on the road to Emmaus. This is a very familiar experience for anyone in this kind of cultural context, but it's also familiar for us. How much of our life is spent traveling from one place to another and then figuring out what we're going to do during that time frame? You know, if it's a 5-minute drive, do you plan ahead for a conversation or do you just get in your car or get out your feet and walk your 5 minutes? You kind of get you out your feet and walk for 5 minutes, right? But if it's going to take you 2 hours and you're not the driver, do you prepare for that? Some of us who are passengers read a book, or if we're a driver, I listen to a book. If I'm driving, you can guarantee that I've got a podcast or a book that I'm trying to finish piping along. So we plan for that. Well, sometimes we actually plan to do something very normal. We're going to talk. We're going to have conversations. If you're with your family, you make plans for the future. You complain about the day or the past. Like, you have normal conversations. And so right here, the text uses this shifting scene going from the tomb. And it says that very day, two of them, we read this last week, were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. So if your walking time for a mile is 20 to 30 minutes, that's a fairly good pace, not bad, not fast. 7 miles, 3.5 hours, 4-hour walk. They're probably better at it than you and I, so let's say a 3-hour walk. So on their 3-hour journey, you could kind of write it this way, Gilligan's Island, 3-hour tour, 3-hour journey, you got it remembered now, it won't forget it. And they were talking with each other about all these things that had happened. Again, super normal, right? But don't just include the last 12 verses. It's not just about the empty tomb. It's not just about the women coming back and saying, hey, there's more going on. It's not just about Peter sprinting to the tomb, figure out what's going on, which is identified in the text as well. It's the big picture. So this is a moment when, on the backdrop of this conversation with these two disciples, unnamed at this point in this particular text, are going, wow, this has been a lot. Because I want to put a simple context for you. The amount of time that they're kind of working with here is roughly equivalent to the time that you and I have dealt with COVID-19. It's a little bit longer for some of them. That the earthly work of Jesus is about 3 years, right? COVID experience for us has been about 2 years. Does COVID seem like a big emotional experience? All right, so we're like, yes, absolutely. There are people who are still dealing with it. Huge health risks for some. Not a big deal for others. It won't go away. All of that. Okay, if that's right here, and biblically and legitimately, COVID concerns in this comparison are like all the way down here. Walking and learning from the Son of God, Jesus, who is performing miracles in your presence and fulfilling the entirety of the biblical story, and you're confused about it. Is that right here? Because if COVID's down here, and I think we can agree that it's down there, comparatively, where do we put what these guys are talking about? Like, kind of a little higher?
A lot higher.
As high as Nephilim can reach, right? That's like, well, if my finger's up, that's 8-ish feet right there. And if we put COVID down there, so we now have a sense of reference for it, right? At least a frame of time and shock to your system. And we can say theirs is easily more substantial. What they're going to go through with this has probably been more world-changing. Because what kind of things are going to have taken place and will take place? Their whole world is being radically rewritten right around them. Verse 15. So while they were talking and discussing together about all of that, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. Now pause for a second and kind of get this picture. You got two disciples. Remember, these are not necessarily lonely roads, because this is a thoroughfare kind of event where everybody kind of has to walk back and forth. So having somebody else on the road, not a big deal. But you're talking about all that Jesus had said and done, and the fact that the grave was empty, and the disciples freaking out about that, because they probably freaking out is a good phrase for the terms that are being used there. And the Son of God, Jesus, just kind of slides in to their convo. That's the bigger setting. But the text says one more thing in verse 16 about their perspective. Do they get to know who Jesus is right away? And I love that the text actually gives us an implicit mystery. Their eyes were kept from recognizing him as Jesus, but it doesn't say how. The miracles of the Bible aren't always all like spelled out for you with paint and numbers and like this color here, this color. That just says, at this point, as Luke records it, they don't know who he is, and it's because of something impacting them. So they don't know that this is Jesus. But we, who have broken the fourth wall of storytelling, we know who he is, right? So does that shift your reading of them at this moment about what they're going to experience, knowing that we know what they don't know? They're having a very familiar experience for us, a conversation on a trip, and grappling with all this. Does that set your stage? Is everyone with me? We're right there for this moment. And he said to them, "What is this conversation that you're holding with each other as you walk?" Pause for a moment. Is this a question that Jesus knows the answer to when he's asking it?
Yes.
Like, he knows what's going down. This is not new, right? This is a totally normal Jesus thing to do, to ask a question that he already knows the possible answers to. What makes it a little bit different is that they're talking about him. And he's, again, slid into the conversation, stealth-like, intentional. And they stood still, looking sad. Is that the response you would expect? I would expect anything on the table at this point with as much going on. So before we read the rest of the story, get to know their names, their circumstances a little bit, what are you guys thinking right here? What's your thought process? Because I don't want to own all the airwaves.
How often does someone you don't know walk up and say, "What are you all talking about?"
That's a different personality, because I do it all the time. It doesn't matter where I am. If someone's there, I might end up being in their wedding and give them enough time. You can come on, show up for the wedding. It's tonight. You going to have snacks? I'm in. So it's all about personality there, but it does happen, right? We tend to respond differently to it. If we're not a very open person and someone is kind of eavesdropping into our conversation, we modulate and get quieter. Rich?
I think what's interesting as well is that this is the first time folks have gotten together after the Sabbath and starting to debrief about all of the events that had just happened. Because they all went to their own homes, right?
Yep.
Spend those hours, and then the next day, the next opportunity, these guys are traveling for whatever business or whatever it might be. But now they get to debrief about all of those events that just happened, and they're able to talk about it.
Yeah. And Shirley, go ahead.
And also the fact that this was something big, news like that would have spread fast, and then somebody would walk up and say, "What are you talking about?" They probably said, "Where you been? Under a rock?"
Yeah, they're about to have that. They're going to have this. Are you the only one who doesn't know this? By the way, that's something that we could all be familiar with, because we all miss out on certain stories or something, family stories, news events, big settings, and all. How did I not know? Why did I not get the memo? Is the kind of feel to it. But again, you start thinking about and kind of chewing through it, you know, Rich points out that this is, from the humanity standpoint, they had gone off into the celebration of the relaxation of the Shabbat, the Sabbath, and so they are now re-engaging with one another. And that includes being after all of these events. They don't have Twitter. That's not how their news spread. Their news spreads by conversation and by writing. They would have notices and posters and stuff like that, but not in the way that we would. One of them, named Calliopas or Calliopas, answered him, "Are you the only, catch it, visitor in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" Like, are you it? Are you the one person who's been underneath a rock? And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, now catch, the little quote mark is going to be in the translations there. This is one of the concise synopsises of what takes place in the life of Jesus. The Bible has a number of them. There's different ways in which different authors will shorthand years worth of a person's life, or even just kind of a small amount of events. And so the shorthand here is going to take into big events. Talks about who he is, where he came from, some of the other aspects of that, and the details that go into thinking about whom Jesus is, what he accomplished, and the relative response to it. So, Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. So, in the Gospels, does it confirm the details of that, including Luke? How he would be a prophet, and he was mighty in deed? Yeah, we get all that. How our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides this, it is now the third day since these things had happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning. When they did not find his body, they came back saying that they had even seen a vision of angels, messengers from God, who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as a woman had said, but they did not see. And he said to them, now pause right there. How many options does Jesus have in response to them? All the things, right? Two factors that shift this for us. One, he knows them. And so his answer is going to be unique to them. But also remember, this event can be considered as chosen to teach us. Because this is not the only people talking about this day, right? Like, we've got a group of disciples who are close discussing it. But this is an all Jerusalem thing. All hands on deck, everybody's possibility. So this particular story is selected because it has benefit to us. And every generation between them and now and beyond. Oh, foolish ones. Raise your hand if you like it when you're foolish or called a fool. So that's one of those easy categories. Ain't nobody like that. And yet, does Jesus do that more than once? Yeah, and so maybe our emotional response to being called a fool or the rational experience of being a fool can be reevaluated in thinking about it this way. We're all fools. That's just a sad reality. Like, we're foolish. And generally, when we are called a fool by someone who knows better, like, could help us, are we better afterwards? If we're humble enough, might be my answer. If we have enough of humility to take our foolishness and put it behind us and be more wise, then we're almost always better off. The only problem is usually us. Like, the only time we're not better off is an us thing, for the most part. He goes on and instructs. Note, he doesn't just reveal himself and go, "Oh, foolish ones, I'm right here." That's not his answer. He teaches. Was it not necessary that the anointed one, the Christ, should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained or interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So he taught them what would be, in essence, the standard process going forward. Because Acts chapter 2, is that what Peter does when he takes his stand with the 11? He connects that Jesus is the descendant of David, who was the king, who was the priest, who was the prophet. When Paul summarizes the life of Jesus in a couple different places, he goes through the same essential process. Every sermon in the book of Acts that you find connects those dots one way or another. And here's a neat thing. When you think of the sermons in the book of Acts, it may be that you immediately think of them in, well, functional terms. Like, well, every book of Acts sermons, somebody gets baptized. That's functional, right? Because someone does a thing after hearing the thing. But informationally, like what causes them to want to make that change is actually this story. That Jesus is the Christ, the anointed of God. Hear ye him. Oh, okay, yeah. I've connected point A to point B. I'll do whatever. Oh, be baptized? No big deal. Sweet. Here's a baptistry, because they're all over the place in Israel. Like, there's mikvahs at this time. Any religious center that's going to be in Israel is going to have what we would consider a baptistry, times at least two outside, one for men, one for women. So, just so you know, like, if you want to feel like you're in Israel, stand right here. And there's a baptistry right there at every single place that there's a church building, a synagogue in Israel. There's at least two of those. So now you're feeling like you're at home with the disciples right then. So that's what's going on. Their response to the education is, we want more. Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and day is now far spent. So he went in to stay with them. Now think about this for a moment. Does the Bible talk to us positively about giving water to a class of people we don't know exactly who they are? Might have shared water with someone who was a messenger from God, unawares. You want to tie an event to an illustration of like what that would look like? Here you go. This is like a great little biblical tie-in to like that actually did happen, even if we read that as a metaphor at times or an illustration. Because there's a literal messenger from God, who is God, basically engaging in the same kind of relational experience. So he went in with them. When he was at table with them, dining, he took the bread and blessed it and broke it and gave to them. And their eyes were open, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. So up to this, like, initial encounter, Jesus kind of slides into their little conversational space and is like, "Hey, what's up? What you talking about? Hey, let me teach you some things. My guy, here's the truth. This is what you got to know. These are the stuff you need to really connect with." And then at the end of it, "Hey, come eat with us. Tell us more. Help us learn more. Help us understand more." Now pause for a second and think about Jesus breaking bread with the disciples just a few days. We're not even at 2 weeks prior, just a few days prior. He make any statements about him doing this again with them? Like when he was going to be ready to partake of a meal with them in the future? Yeah, absolutely he did. And he said it was going to be coming only in the future. after some things had to happen, kingdom level things. So that kind of shifts our full setting of what's going on and our full picture of what's possible here to the point that Jesus is kind of partially, by his behavior, confirming kingdom level knowledge. Hey, the kingdom that you're looking for, that's now a real thing. We can come into it now. Gospel is going to be preached later. It's going to have its fullness in the biggest picture. But again, get back with our two dudes, our two disciples. I say dudes generically, our two disciples. They don't know who he is. It's being held from them. Once they know, the text again gives us a mystery. He vanishes. Try to be those two people at the table with Jesus for a moment. Whose world got rocked?
Theirs.
Absolutely. And they were already perplexed about the women who had gone, the other disciples who had gone to check that out. And now they are having a unique to them risen Savior moment, an educational moment, where now they learn and they know and they see and they recognize. All right. They said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? You want a great little another tie-in? There's a phrase used in the book of Acts, specifically in this case with Peter's sermon, where everybody hearing him preach is responding to the message, and it says it pierced their hearts. This is a great concept of tie-in where that is kind of equivalent to this. Because we know it's not a literal piercing, right? And it's not even just the emotional response to, hey, this is big, we shouldn't have done that. It's not about guilt or even godly sorrow, although it is connected to that. It's the sinking in of the weight of God's plan in front of it is here and there and in all those other tied-in passages. So that's kind of setting. We got a little bit of text left. We'll read that in a second, in the last few verses of this section. But now what do you guys respond to or think or see? What's going on for each of you, Rich?
So they had an aha moment.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, we've been listening to this guy, and he's kind of connecting all the dots for us, which is nice. And it's probably someone that, they've been supposed to be listening to the scribes and teachers of all, throughout their lifetime. And here's someone that's coming in and connecting all the dots. I'm like, wow, that's really good. Let's have some dinner. And then they, he gets revealed, and I like the poof moment. Poof, he's gone.
Yeah.
And that's just something that's like, when you hear all of that, and then they talk about how their hearts were burning when he was talking to them on the road. So they're starting to connect it all, and they're like, man, this really makes a lot of sense. And it's really exciting, and it's amazing.
Yeah. And you start catching this. Anyone ever hear this of the phrase, come to Jesus moment? That's this. Like, it's not just about, hey, you're getting straightened out because you were wrong. Their ignorance is being washed away. The difference here is Jesus came to them. He came to them to check, to see, to learn where they are at. Not so much educationally or informationally, to help us learn through them, through their experiences. Text continues here. They rose that same hour, now after eating, after meal, returned to Jerusalem. They found the 11, that's the core disciples who would become our apostles, and those who were with them gathered together, saying, the Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. But then they told what had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of bread. And so it's at that moment that they get to tie together things that went from the tomb to the table to their hearts. Because now we're seeing all of this come full circle in that regard, where it goes from one to the other. That's you and I. That's our social experience as well. Because it goes from the tomb to whatever table you were sitting at the first time you really connected those biblical stories together as being more than just a story, having relevance to the creation and to God, and that you mattered in all of that. You're going to go through different points of life where you reconnect to that same story over and over again, much like each of them are reconnecting each of the aspects of this. So that kind of creates for us a moment to think. We've got our five questions. They'll show up. Don't be thinking that we're not going to have those, because I'm still going to shove them at you for a little while longer. But I want to ask this question and connect this little tidbit for you. These few verses, how easy would it be for you to sit down at a table with someone right now and just read that with them and talk about Jesus to them? That hard thing? Not really, right? Because you're reading it. Hey, what do you think? Do you realize that what you would be doing at that point is exactly what's like going on in the text? They're all doing the same thing. If you want to think about evangelism in a practical application space, like how do I personally go talk to someone about God? That's what you do. And no, you don't actually have to open your Bible right away. Because you know what the people in the story aren't doing? Are they carrying around like the giant scrolls with them? That's something that's hard for us to picture, is the size and scale of the biblical text in the time of the disciples. Because how small can our Bibles get? Only as small as I can read the print. Like, that's my only standard. And that's gotten bigger over the years. They used to be tiny, but now I got to have big print. Right? But for the most part, we can get the entire biblical canon in our hand. A printed version of it, right? They don't have any of that. They can pull up the scrolls. And here's a way to think about it. For them to read from Isaiah, it's probably three scrolls to get Isaiah. And these are scrolls that are going to be yay big, but yay thick for each scroll. So, you know, a bit like the size of maybe a roll of paper towels is the smallest it's going to be for one portion of an Isaiah scroll. And that even doesn't affect the fact of how expensive it is. So none of them have their Bibles with them, but they could tell the story. So you and I can and should do the same thing. Because it's an application point, because we can talk about it, right? Remember when the disciples were talking about the empty tomb? And how they had to go through all that experience. And now you can talk about Jesus in a very comfortable, easy way. And tell people about a story that can change their lives. And by the way, I'll say this real quick. Every story is simply a story. And some of them are not true. And some are true. So whenever we're talking about the Bible stories, we're talking about true stories. So that term story is perfectly okay. You know, sometimes we think stories are made up. It's not. Your family story isn't made up. Your personal story isn't made up. Neither is the Bible story.
Yeah, we don't always get everything that's going on. But when I read through here, and it says it's, you know, getting towards evening.
Yeah.
Yet they turn right around and take another 3-hour trip back.
Yeah.
But remember, there's a lot of excitement in town. Matthew's the only one who talks about it in chapter 27, but all the dead have raised.
Yeah, there's other risen people. 500, I think, is the sum total in one of the accounts of tombs that open up. There's prophetic edges of that. There are demonstrated God's power edges of that. And so they're going back, not into a peaceful space where it's just a few people having an academic discussion. Hey, let's get all the facts on the table now and make our plans. Everyone is still shocked. bewildered and amazed, because many of them are having their own unique risen Savior moments. And so that's all of them back into this relatively small space, physically small space. Jerusalem at this time is not sprawling and big. It is bound up within the walls. And so it's not a very big, demanding space when they go back to it. And even if they go to the outer city, which is the small homes that will be around it, it's still not big. I'm talking about City of David, which is like a community at this point next to Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. But now we get to ask probably the easiest set of these questions ever. Because do these few verses have something to like? Unlike some of our stories, we're like, I don't like any of it. I don't like 1 ounce of one letter, of one little punctuation mark in all of that that we just read. But that's the opposite here, right? This one for me is like, how do I pick the one thing I like the most? That's why you get to go first. So what are the things that you guys, y'all liked in here? Anything particular is your favorite part of this?
Mine is the way the Lord Jesus presented himself, just coming in and seeing these men and talking with them, not really telling them, or they did not know it was him until the time that he wanted to make sure they knew it was him.
Right. He educated before he showed. You know, there was an example before the telling of all the facts. Now, I look at that same story and I go, come on. Why are you messing with me? Like, that's my mind going in, like, right here. Just come in and show me. But there's a good reason why, in many cases, we don't do the same thing. Like, we don't reveal stuff until later because we want people to know. And Jesus is doing that here. What else? Shirley, do you have something? Yeah, you know, you look at that. God is going to give us the opportunities and moments we need to encounter the knowledge that we're going to benefit from. Like, there's a connection there, too.
I like that point that they had burning hearts to desire to know what was.
Like, did not our hearts burn within us when he was talking to us? Like, did we feel that? Remember, the Bible heart isn't indigestion here. This is not like, why did I eat that? This is. When they talk about the heart in this regard, it's did not we ourselves, what makes us us. Did you feel that? Well, didn't it feel different when he was talking to us? All of that comes in there. The poof moment is pretty big too. Like when, not just because of the mystery of him vanishing, but when it happens. And then we were breaking bread. And he was gone. We saw who he was. We finally caught it. And at that moment, because that moment is significant as it ties into the other biblical stories. And I love that when these things layer together and you see them connect that way where the stuff lines up where, hey, this is a big thing. It's a big thing. Him sharing a meal, breaking bread with the disciples is always a big thing. Not just in the communal ones where they do it, even when he breaks bread with just one person who needs his support and encouragement. I really like that. It might be my favorite part of this, but it's hard to pick one.
Another thing that is exciting is that they could not wait to get back to Jerusalem so they could share his story with the others that were there. They couldn't even wait
for the
morning. They had to leave. I'm sure
it was dark by then. Yeah, their excitement has risen to the go and tell level. Like, I got to go tell somebody about this. We got to go tell everybody else about this. We got to get together. Everyone needs to know what we know. Because again, they're leaving after not really seeing or understanding, but now they've been given biblical connections that you and I take for granted, things that we already know. also note this, and it kind of helps us catch the slow process of their understanding. So when Jesus says, verse 26, was it not necessary for the Christ, or was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? The struggle for most of the disciples at this point is probably one that you and I can connect with, is that they didn't really appreciate Isaiah's prophecy and the overall biblical picture of the suffering of the Christ. They wanted to skip that over. Just to go from, hey, you're the anointed one, boom, you're the king, you're going to rescue Israel. This is so sweet. You and I do the same thing. We want to skip the middle part, right? We do that when we're shopping for food. How many of you would really like it if you went to the grocery store and all of the meat was live and the butcher just cut it up for you right there? Like no, I'm good. I kind of like it fancily prepared and cleaned up for me. But we've done that to our culture, right? Because that's not how it's always been. That's like a 100-year shift. 100 years ago, most of the process was a lot closer to you, right? We've asked this before, how many people have processed their own chicken? Like, that's a low one. And Bobby's like, I've done that. Right? Okay, so we've sanitized that. We've taken the suffering away because we don't want to see that or have that. Now I want to make a connection for you. Artistically, disciples over the generations from the time of Jesus till now have expressed their understanding of these events through art, right? We still do that. How many times has a kid given you their drawing from a church service? And if you're the preacher, almost always there's some Vincent van Gogh drawing of what I look like to them from the pew, and that's what they're seeing. But if you go back in time, even just 100 years, some of the art, even amongst Christians you and I would worship with, is more sensitive to suffering than what we produce now. And if you go back 100 more years, and another 100 years, and another 100 years to, say, 1,000 years ago, there's far more emphasis on the suffering of disciples in art than there is today in our art today. And the reason I think that's important is because that's a struggle for us to connect with, to connect the suffering like this. Because generally, this is basically true, that if the Bible was literalized into a media source, like a movie, none of you would send your children to watch it. And that includes me. Right? It's just a fact. Because think of what's in there. Is there blood and gore in there? On the kind of level that would just be stomach-wrenching. Is there sexual immorality in the Bible story? Yeah. The kind of which that you actively as parents try to avoid for yourself and for your children. And yet we read it. And so there's a middle space there that we're trying to achieve, which understands these things at various points when we develop, but doesn't lose the weight of them that's lost in a bland, textual, academic read of the Bible. I think that's important because unlike them from 1,000 years ago, or us from today, the people who are experiencing this, what kind of personal knowledge did they have about crucifixion? Is crucifixion a private slaying of a life or a public one? Would they have been there? Possibly, for that one or another one. So when they talk about the suffering of Jesus, when Jesus talks about it to them, it's far more personal. Especially when you get to the 11. Because some of them were there. Like as there as they could be. So when he talks about his suffering, they connect with it, we connect with it. I think that's super important for us to find a way to learn from in a way that's appropriate to our own culture, but also really rooted in the biblical text. Like this is something God needs us to understand because He didn't just go from anointed to king. He went anointed through suffering to king. And biblically, you and I do the same thing. We are anointed, baptized. We suffer in view of glory. Rich?
Yeah, just one little side point. I think that it appears that these gentlemen or these folks were part of a group that had met in the morning, listened to the women. The women dug the grave. They came back, told their story. And then I think when they met and recognized it was Jesus, they went back, found the 11. And it gives credibility to, because they're part of that group. They're like, we saw him. We saw him too. And I think that drives back to what Luke is saying in chapter 1 and verse 2. These are eyewitnesses.
Yeah.
These are eyewitness accounts.
Yeah.
And that gives more credibility.
Perspiration along with inspiration. That's what you kind of see right there, where he's coming back. People who were there, who experienced, who saw, who recognized, who felt. And you get a lot of the feelings here in Luke's account. That's it for our time in our class this morning. We'll continue our study with that hopefully next Sunday. But very thankful for your participation.